And it's 23 minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday morning, and Doug Greenwald joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, also the Executive Director thereunto pertaining, and has a lot to teach us about biblical context. That's the purpose of the ministry. And, Doug, it's springtime in Maryland. What are the signs of spring in Maryland going on right now?
Well, the cherry blossoms presumably are out. In fact, they're actually out in my side yard. But as I look out my office window, a white blanket of snow is increasingly coming down.
What?
They're forecasting 4 to 8 inches today in different parts of the area north of D.C. So we'll see.
Okay.
You got the nor'easter coming. Yeah, that's right.
I missed the news. I try to avoid the news, and
the fourth one in about a day and a half.
And the 6-day forecast, the temperatures don't get out of the 40s.
Okay. Whoa.
Well, I'll tell you what, Gisele Sorley's going to be loving this. If you get
It makes me feel like I'm in Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, they got snow. They got about an inch of snow. Of course, now our studios are down here in Central Texas, and we're looking at pretty close to 80 degrees today and sunshine. But we're suffering through it. We're bearing up under the pressure here and doing just fine. Doug, this is disconcerting. I don't know how this is happening, but your picture is inverted. You're upside down. Do you see that?
Yeah, it shows that way on my screen as well.
Okay.
I have no explanation for it. Other than what Jesus is going to do in John 11 here, totally turns things upside down.
Well, yeah, he does. I'm just afraid all the blood is going to rush to your head, and I've never seen you in this position before. But I'll see if I can take you seriously. And
you know, I got a scholarship for yoga. Maybe that's part of the explanation.
That could be. Yeah. Well, we've got a heavy duty topic today because a lot of us, you know, hear about the resurrection of Lazarus at the hands of Jesus and all the people that were around and they were so amazed, but we missed the point of how skillfully and how adeptly Jesus was managing his march back to Jerusalem in order to set up his own execution.
That's true. First observation when it comes to Lazarus, the only person to have to die twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's dead center in God's will.
Mm-hmm.
Mary and Martha had to mourn twice. And they're dead centered in God's will. And so, you know, at 5,000 feet, you realize here that our lives aren't necessarily supposed to be filled with convenience.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to reveal God's will through us. And sometimes that's in difficult circumstances. So that's always intrigued me about that situation. But I think the bigger backdrop here that people miss, this is like a 30,000-foot perspective here, is what has been going on between Jesus and the aristocracy leadership in Jerusalem. When we ask ourselves what's happened before we get to John 11, we realize that Jesus has brought back two people back to life. One was Jairus' 12-year-old daughter in Luke 8, and then he also did the same thing for the only son of the widow of Nain in Luke 7.
Now, accept this, and I don't mean to distract you, but this goes back to some things you've taught us in the past. Jesus was considered by the establishment as one of the northern Pharisees who were known to do miracles.
The Hasidim, miracle-working Pharisees, sort of like the Mother Teresa's of their day, absolutely. But they did, I'll call it plain vanilla miracles, exorcisms and, you know, healings for the flu and a cold and, you know, that sort of thing. None of them brought anyone back from the dead.
Mm.
So we're in a different category here. In fact, when you read what some of the rabbis have said in the Mishnah, you can find rabbinic citations that say this: healing a leper is as difficult as bringing someone back from the dead. It will only happen when Messiah comes. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So this underscores Jesus' very first public miracle after he's called his first disciples in Luke. He heals a leper. That's intentional. That's deliberate. And he's also brought two people back to life in the first day that they died, because you have to be buried on the day you died in this culture. Well, there also is a Jewish view of death. And they look at a dead person, and in their way of thinking, the nefesh, or the nefesh, if you want to put the pronunciation on the last syllable here, is the Hebrew word for soul. And it is viewed to hover over the body for 3 days, waiting to re-enter. But by the time of the fourth day, the body is already in such a state of rapid decomposition, you can't even recognize the person who died. And the stench is unbearable, and therefore the nefesh flees. The aristocracy has to argue that Jesus is not Messiah, because the rabbis have also contended that when Messiah comes, he will go straight to Jerusalem, to the temple, establish his throne, and rule politically and militarily. And if that turns out to be the case, and they're convinced that's how Messiah will arrive and reign, then their gig is up running Temple Incorporated, the biggest cash cow machine of antiquity, running 8 businesses out of the temple, most of them corruptly. And so it's sort of a showdown at the OK Corral. The Jewish aristocracy running temple, the board of directors, if you will, cannot allow Messiah to build. So they have to explain away Jesus's 2 apparent miracles of bringing someone back to life by saying, oh, but they're only first day miracles. The nefesh still hasn't fled. And therefore, it's like, I'll put it in our vernacular here, those two people were in a coma, but they hadn't really died. And therefore, Jesus really isn't Messiah. Okay? So what Jesus wants to do here intentionally is to take that argument away from the Jerusalem establishment and do a fourth day miracle when there is no question that the nefesh is already gone, and therefore this is an impossible miracle. It's like in the Jewish worldview, for the first 3 days you're dead, but from the fourth day and thereafter, you're dead. Okay? So Lazarus and Mary and Martha are all woven into this plan. And it starts out in John 11 with Lazarus deteriorating, and Mary and Martha have a messenger go and find Jesus in Perea, which is a 2-day walk away. Jesus is in the Jordan Valley, about a day's north walking from Jericho. It's the winter. It's probably mid to late February. It's 1,000 feet below sea level in Perea in the Jordan Valley, and therefore it's warm. And when you have an outdoor itinerant ministry like Jesus does, you're in warm places in the winter, and you avoid the cold, snowy places in the winter, and that's why they know sort of where he is. And so the messenger gets sent off, and he eventually finds Jesus. And what I find interesting here, the first thing Jesus does is to tell the messenger, you tell Mary and Martha, this is an illness that will not end in death, but so that God can be glorified. The word glorified, to the Hebrew way of thinking, means to accurately reveal and portray. And so what Jesus is about to do is going to accurately reveal and portray who he is, how he does things, and what he's all about. And so the messenger gets sent back, and if you do the arithmetic here, he arrives sort of late in the day, the second day after Lazarus died. How do I know that? Because Jesus arrives on the fourth day after Lazarus died back in the Bethany area, and therefore it must have been a 2-day walk, because Luke tells us Jesus stayed 2 more days where he was after hearing the news from the messenger. And just to do an insert here, if you got a call on the phone or a text message from hospice that one of your best friends is in his last hours, could you please get over here quickly? Would you wait 2 days before you moseyed over to hospice?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think so. And yet Jesus did. So this is a very deliberate delay, a very intentional delay, because Jesus wants to perform this miracle on the fourth day, not on the second day. If he had done the second day, they still have the nefesh argument at the Jewish aristocracy. That's, of course, Lazarus was in a coma for 2 days. Therefore, Yeshua really didn't bring him back to life. Therefore, he's really not Messiah. So when Lazarus comes forth, he is like the Goodyear blimp flying over the greater Jerusalem area saying, Yeshua is Messiah. Yeshua is Messiah. There is no more argument about the three-day nephesh hovering over the body. That's gone. There is no more question that Jesus is Messiah. It's unquestionable. Everybody knows it. In fact, at the end of John 11, the establishment says, if he keeps on doing like miracles like this, everyone's going to follow him. And then Caiaphas says, don't you get it? It's better that one man die than that we lose our franchise here running Temple Incorporated. And so the raising of Lazarus seals the deal for Jesus. He's going to die. And the raising of Lazarus makes sure that there will be a cross and there will be an empty tomb. And that's why John 11 is so pivotal as a transition point here, that not only starts the 40 days of Lent, but it makes sure that Calvary is going to happen. It's all intentional. It's all part of the plan. Mary and Martha didn't know it. Lazarus didn't know it, but God was at work doing his thing perfectly in his timing. And so if you pause for a moment and put yourself in Mary and Martha's shoes, they don't know any of this. All they know is that they have put Jesus up for a number of Passovers, let him stay for the better part of a week in Bethany. This whole culture works on social reciprocity. If I do something good for you, you're obligated to do something good for me. They've repeatedly put him up for a couple of weeks. Okay, they know he knows that. They know about social reciprocity, and there is no question in their mind that he is going to respond. And so when Lazarus actually dies, no problem. Jesus will get here before sundown and bring him back to life. And guess what? Jesus doesn't show at the end of the first day of Lazarus' death. And so they put him in the tomb and they start to wonder, what happened? Why didn't Jesus show up? You know, and I want to insert here a thought. I think all of us, at some point in our past, either for a moment or for a period of time or maybe for even a season of our life, can get close to feeling that sometimes God has let us down. He just didn't show up when we needed him. So now we go to the second day. And they're perplexed, they're puzzled, they're frustrated, they may well even be angry. And toward the end of the second day, the messenger reappears in Bethany and says, oh, boy, do I have good news. I talked to Yeshua. I told him about Lazarus, and this is the first thing he said. This is an illness that will not end in death, but so that God can be glorified. And Mary and Martha say, what? He said that? You must have misunderstood. Lazarus died. He's dead. He's buried. He's in the tomb. No. The messenger says, that's what Jesus said. Well, they can't make sense out of that. At the end of the second day, there's no Jesus. So we get to the third day. And in my, what I hope is creative interpolation here, little after the noon hour, I don't know whether it would be Mary or whether it was Martha who said, oh, I get it. I see the picture. He is going to bring Lazarus back to life before the end of the third day arrives. This is going to be spectacular. This won't be the same day he died bringing back to life miracle like he did in the other two situations. We're special in his eyes. We're so special, in fact, he's going to do a third day bringing back to life. Call the Jerusalem Post. Get CNN on the line here. They got to be present for this incredible miracle because Jesus loves us so. We're going to be special. And the sun sets on the third day, and there's no Yeshua, no Jesus. Now, how are we thinking and feeling, Mary and Martha's? Now, do you feel totally let down, totally perplexed, totally disappointed? And while they're having perhaps these thoughts, they're still dead centered in God's will. God's will, his plan, continues to unfold in an unimpeded manner. And then they get a message halfway through the fourth day. Jesus is down at the well at Ein Shemesh, which is just a little bit around the curve on the path to Bethany from the Judean wilderness. And Martha goes down there and said, Lord, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus says, didn't I tell you he wouldn't die? Oh, yes, I know in the end days he'll come back to life. No, Jesus says. And then Mary and Martha switch places. And Mary says, Lord, if you'd have been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And Jesus says, where is he? And Jesus weeps at the consequences that death inflicts on relationships because of sin. And he gets to the tomb and he says, remove the slab. And he says, Lazarus, come forth. And out of the tomb comes Lazarus, wrapped in his burial cloths. And now Lazarus is exhibit A, that Jesus is Messiah. Lazarus is now as wanted a man as Jesus is. His picture, along with Jesus, is going to be on every palm tree, wanted, dead or alive.
Okay? Now, this was a very public event, too. This didn't happen in isolation.
Oh, it would have spread like wildfire. It quickly got back to the Sanhedrin, as I've already indicated. And they said, if this continues, everyone's going to believe in him. Everyone's going to follow him. We need an intervention here. And the intervention is this: better that one person die than we all lose our gig here running Temple Incorporated.
How prophetic was that statement by Caiaphas? And do you suppose he knew it? Or was it just a statement of political fact?
He's the ultimate pragmatist.
Yeah.
That's the only solution.
Mm-hmm.
If he really is Messiah, we need to kill him. Because if he truly is Messiah, our gig is over. And, you know, remember I said before, the expectation is that when Messiah comes, he'll go straight to the temple and set up his throne and reign. Well, on Palm Sunday, guess what Jesus does? He basically gets coronated king.
Mm-hmm.
By coming down, that's Palm Sunday, that's this coming Sunday, coming down Gethsemane's hillside there from the Mount of Olives on a donkey. And he goes straight to the temple, and everyone expects him to set up his throne and reign. And what does he do? He casts out the animal sellers and their animals. Yeah, he did go straight to the temple, but he did something very, very different. And so it's just a marvelous story. I mean, it teaches us all kinds of things. One is not to have rigid expectations about what we expected Jesus to do and when we expect him to do it. We're such microwave technology people now that if there's a problem in our life, we want it fixed in 2 minutes on Power 10.
You know, you've told us from the beginning, from the get-go, that everything Jesus did in his ministry, everything we read about in the Gospels, was intentional. Meaning raising Jairus' daughter or the widow of Nain's son was intentional. In other words, this didn't happen by accident. It wasn't coincidence that these people were where they were, doing what they were doing, being who they were. He was picking elements of the culture and proving his identity to them.
They were all in the master script of God's impeccable plan to set the stage for this week, coming week, the Passion of Jesus.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I think we realize here, too, that God's providence can certainly perplex us for a time or a season, right? But it doesn't mean he's still at work,
mm-hmm.
or not at work.
Mm-hmm.
He is. It's just that, like even with Zachariah and Elizabeth, God was at work all that time, and they had no idea. And at some future moment in time, it becomes clearer through the rearview mirror what was going on and why it was going on. And I think even in our own lives, the older we become, and the more history we have in our own rearview mirrors, we can see that the dots really do connect, mm-hmm. even though there may have been long periods of time when we were convinced there's no connecting going on at all. Yeah. Everything in God's economy adds up. Nothing is ever lost in his economy, and there's tremendous assurance there in the life of average believer that God knows what he's doing. He's never made a mistake. And he's certainly not about to start with your life and mine.
Mm. You know, I made a statement in our chat window this morning, teasing this topic this morning, and I call it the beginning of the end of the beginning. This was a very complex set of timing requirements, and it really started into motion that last 40 days, which I suspect we're going to learn more about over the next couple of weeks.
And you know what our theme at the summer conference is going to be next year in 2019?
Mm-hmm. What?
The last 40 days of Jesus, greatest story never totally told.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to that. And talking to Doug Greenwald, I want to mention to you that if you've benefited from his teaching today, you should know about our entire library of podcasts at Broken Road Radio. You can go up to the podcast page, click on Doug's name, and you'll see everything in chronological order. Many, many teaching sessions with us that just open your eyes to so many things, and we're so blessed to have him.
Let me just add one more thought. Several months ago, I was filmed by Lamb and Lion Ministries to be their Easter special on a TV program for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I do an interview with Lazarus and Barabbas, basically. That's going to be airing Easter week on 7 different religious cables.
Okay.
And it's going to also be on Vimeo. And if folks want to see it, just sign up for our reflections on the PBT website, and you'll receive a link to see me in person develop both Barabbas and Lazarus during that Lenten window of time.
And of course, PBT is Preserving Bible Times. The website is preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to it from the Broken Road page if you like. And there's a wealth of information there, too. And we suggest that you do that. Doug, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, Doug.